As a longtime record collector, I owe so much to distros. One-stop shops for getting the best releases from all my favorite labels in one place. That's where Devil Dog Distro comes in. Based in the UK and leading the charge in aggressive music for record collectors, they're the official home of Triple B, Daze, Asian Man, New Morality Zine, Iodine, Maggot Stomp, and they're even kind enough to carry releases from my label, Secret Voice Records. You can get 10% off your order by using the code FIRSTEVER, spelled out FIRSTEVER, at checkout when you visit devildogdistro.com. And if you're in the UK, you get free shipping on orders over £100. And if you're in the EU, you get free shipping on orders over £150. So visit devildogdistro.com and use the code FIRSTEVER to get 10% off your order. Welcome to the First Ever Podcast. My name is Jeremy Bohm. I am your host. And if this is your first time here, this is a show where I interview artists of all kinds about the first experiences in their art form that led them to where they are today. This is episode 187. And my guest this week is Alex Estrada. This man is a very good friend, a very close collaborator, someone that I admire, someone that I respect, someone that I seek guidance from when it comes time for Touche Amore to do a new album. So that being said, I've been seeing him a lot lately just because Touche starts recording officially very soon. So we always do pre-pro demos with Alex, and he's also, of course, recorded To the Beat of a Dead Horse, a lot of our split material, a lot of songs that ended up on compilations, things like that. But I've worked with him a lot, and he's the first person I go to when it comes time to getting myself comfortable with what I'm trying to do vocally. What I'm getting at is Alex is incredibly instrumental in the Touche Amore multiverse, as well as the Joyce Manor multiverse. We talked about him a lot on the Barry episode, as well as the Matt Ebert episode. If you haven't checked those out, you should go do that, because those are pretty fun episodes. Alex has a newer studio. He always worked out of LA, but now he has this amazing spot called Pale Moon Ranch. It's out in Juniper Hills, California. Feel free to look up where that is, and you'll be like, wow, that is out there. And that is, my friends, the charm of it, because it is secluded and it is beautiful. You get every season you can think of just, you know, a handful of miles outside of LA proper. It's still LA County. Don't get that twisted. But it's an amazing space. I've been out there a few times. I'm going out there this week. You're hearing this on Wednesday. Guess what? On Thursday, I'm back at Pale Moon Ranch. Also, before we get to the interview, of course, for new listeners, there's a bonus episode available right now where Alex answered questions that were submitted by subscribers. You can access that by going over to patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon. You can subscribe for as little as $3 a month and get access to that bonus episode and all of the other bonus material. If you subscribe for just a little bit more, you yourself can ask questions to upcoming guests. And there's a Discord channel, all sorts of fun stuff. It would mean a lot. Once again, that is patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon. Or you can find that link in the episode description. All right. Oh, should I mention this? I just got back from Australia. Touche did a tour there. It was amazing. If you came out to that tour, thank you. It was a long time coming, and it was so wonderful to be back there. We love being in Australia, and we're sorry it took so long to get back out there. And we will do our damnedest to get back much sooner this next time around. So thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, without further ado, here is my conversation with the veganist man with the most perfect pitch. It's the one and only Alex Estrada. What's up, Alex? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I am doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
How's the weather out in Juniper Hills this morning?
It's a crispy one today. Yesterday was really nice. Today it's like in the 40s and raining a bit and super windy.
And, I haven't even thought about the wind out there. Does it just get like violent?
70 mile per hour gusts.
Jesus
Christ. People lose their roofs out here. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. So for people listening, Alex, how long have you been out there now?
It's going to be 2 years in March.
Alex lives out on it's like 2 acres of land, right?
Yeah, just over 2 acres.
In a part of California that if you put a gun to my head and said, drive me to Juniper Hills without using a map, I would be like, you're just going to have to pull the trigger. but it's this incredible plot of land where he has a studio that he also lives out of. It's just about the most beautiful place in the entire world. So it's amazing. But you also get to experience every different kind of weather that California somehow has to offer. And you're only 45 minutes from where I live.
Yeah, it's crazy. This is the far north edge of LA County. And I mean, last year we got 36 inches of snow. I got trapped here for 14 days.
Oh my God. I
had to have friends with 4x4 trucks bring me groceries and water. And I
it
was
really
in
got
LA.
That gnarly.
Yeah. You've seen my driveway. So it's like the driveway coming up to my front porch is like a 350-foot gravel road that's like, you know, it's a steep grade. So once the first snow hit, it made a sheet of ice on the bottom, and then all the snow above it just packed in. So, I mean, I was sledding on the driveway. It was like, you know, I drive a little hatchback car. Like, I couldn't get that down the driveway. The road was plowed. I haven't fully subscribed to the mountain life yet. You know, the Jeep is on its way, but for
you
now...
You have a nice flannel on today, so you're baby steps.
Oh, yeah. I got so much turquoise going on underneath all this. I'm like, yeah. I went on vacation in New Mexico like a month ago and came back just fully dialed in, ready, you know, Tractor Supply gift card, just going for it.
So, I mean, you and I just hung out, I think it was week before last or last week, and I'm going to see you this weekend, this coming week or whatever. But you and I were talking about at some point sort of the subtle changes you're having to make in the way that you operate just due to learning experiences, especially now that you're in this bigger plot, you have more expenses and things like that. Something that just popped in my head as you were describing that or talking about like the difficulty of all of a sudden not being able to leave your place for 2 weeks. Are you now having to take into account like, oh, there's going to be weeks where literally I can't book because it's going to be impossible for people to be here? Like, is that something new or are you just going to try to figure that out?
I mean, it's definitely new. I guess we all kind of had a crash course in that in 2020 because it's like, cool, none of us can, nobody in the creative musical field can meet up and do anything, you know? So with that, you know, no one could control the weather. That's the only real factor. So I kept booking. I didn't leave any holes in my schedule this winter. Last year, I probably would have, but even last year, I didn't have to cancel anything. It just worked out where I ended up just mixing. Even if I was stuck here for 2 weeks, I had like one dude, this guy Vinny's in a band called Grave Secrets. He has a huge Bronco, like a 4x4 Bronco. So he would just hit me up and he's like, hey, I'm coming up from the valley. Like, do you want groceries? I'll pick you up groceries. And he would come and we would track songs and it just worked out really cool. But yeah, this year I didn't have to cancel anything. I've been booked nonstop. So I'm just crossing my fingers whenever I get those like flash flood warnings, those like extreme weather warnings. And I just got to tell bands like, hey, you know, just take it slow up here.
Yeah, it makes sense to also maybe just like if you see that on the horizon, be like, okay, maybe I could just I'll just focus on mixing for these next 2 weeks or something like that. Like that does make a lot of sense. Also, I want to just mention, you mentioned that no one can control the weather. The rest of this podcast, we're just going to talk about chemtrails. So, where do you land on?
Oh, you mean cloud seeding? Well, first of all, what's cool is I live so close to Edwards Air Force Base that, and you've seen like the view, my house is just this like panoramic giant window.
Yeah.
So every morning you just see like military jets, military helicopters, like you see what, you know, people would deem chemtrails pretty often out here.
Totally.
And because it's so high, you know, I'm at 4,700 feet up here. They look to be at eye level. when you're here. It's not like they're way above you the way it felt when I was living on the other side of the mountains.
Right.
But yeah, there's that. And yeah, as far as the whole weather thing, I haven't had to change anything really with bands. And it's the opposite. People see photos of this place in the snow and I got more bookings than ever because they just want to here when there's snow. So, you know, I had bands booking out like 2 weeks. We want 2 weeks at the end of February. We want a week in the beginning of March just because we want to be there in that environment, you know?
Right.
And they want it's an hour from LA, so.
Yeah, they want the whole exactly. Jack Torrance vibe. Yeah.
That's exactly what they want, so.
So, this is going to be one of those circumstances where I'm interviewing a friend that has been in my life for 20 years. I've known you probably, if not, maybe longer. Something like that. Yeah.
We probably met around 2005, so just under 20 years.
Yeah, that's really
2004
crazy
maybe
about.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
I was still in high school. Yeah.
Man, so that being said, it's like it's always funny when I interview somebody I've known this long because I'm still going to find out things about you that I did not know or ask you questions that are just like seemingly surface level, but maybe I just don't have the full scope of things. Mm-hmm. Because our friendship is, you know, pretty rooted in recording and talking music and you and your help and all of that sort of stuff. But I guess right out the gate, I'm obviously you're from LA, but from what I know, right, you were born and raised in LA.
Yeah, I was born in East LA, born in Boyle Heights, San Gabriel Valley. Yeah,
okay, that's what I was curious of, like what the actual city you were born in was.
Yeah, I was born in like East LA, Boyle Heights, like some little clinic out there. And that's where my family's been rooted in that general area, City Terrace, East LA, you know.
Did you have one house that you basically stayed in most of your life?
Yeah, till I was about 14. I lived in Monterey Park, which is just east of like East LA. So okay. That's where I was forever. And I stayed in the San Gabriel Valley up until I moved here.
You know, it gets mentioned a lot in a lot of, you know, articles about you or interviews with you and stuff like that, that, you know, your father is a famous mariachi singer. His name is Jose Hernandez Estrada. When growing up with that, like, was music is prominent in the household, or maybe because he was doing it, was it less prominent because that was work?
So I actually didn't grow up in his household. So he's Jose Hernandez. My mom's Estrada. So I grew up with my mom with like visits from my dad, you know, once a month. But totally. It was split pretty even down the middle because my dad, you know, a longtime mariachi musician. My family's seven generations of mariachis going back, you know, into the 1800s. Like they have it all traced back there in like some of the most, you know, important foundational groups of that genre. But then on my mom's side, you know, her mom was an opera singer. Her dad was like a USO performer in the military. Wow. And then my mom was a professional flocorico dancer who was like touring with Linda Ronstadt when I was a kid. So that was like, I grew up around that more than anything. So when I would be with my dad for the occasional weekend here and there, it was like, cool, he's in the studio. And at the time, yeah. I didn't really get it. I was just bored in the waiting room of the studio. And
yeah.
But yeah, it was a musical household nonetheless, but it was my mom's house and it was just always full of music.
So that actually leads to a great question. The first question I usually ask musicians, because with your folks being so involved with music, what was the first thing that you connected with musically that felt like it was yours? Maybe not something your parents were showing you, but something that you found to give you a sense of identity.
So I want to say being a child born in the mid 80s, my musical memory goes real, real far back. You know, I remember things from like 89, 90 when I was 4 or 5 years old. The first of which I loved Paula Abdul. I loved Debbie Gibson. I loved Ace of Base. Like all those like electronic female fronted, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like that real keyboard heavy thing. That was the first thing.
Yeah. And also like some of that, when you revisit a lot of that stuff, a lot of the background beats are almost aggressive. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like they're like pretty totally. Hard. Yeah.
Janet Jackson, like some of that stuff, if you A and B it with like modern day industrial music or think, you know, some like Skinny Puppy, Frontline Assembly, stuff like that, like they share a lot in common.
Absolutely.
Those are the first ones I really remember listening to on my own, was trying to play along to like The Sign, the Ace of Base record, or Paul Abdul, Forever Your Girl. And, you know, some of that, I don't really remember my mom being into it. She was listening to a lot of Spanish music, and I really remember her liking Steve Winwood, who I also liked as a kid.
Okay.
Random one.
What's the band Steve Winwood was Blind Faith. So he's in a band called Blind Faith, right? And Blind Faith also has Eric Clapton in it, right?
Oh, so
if you look at this Blind Faith album cover, it's like a beige-ish white cover, kind of like an whatever, and it has a band photo. It sounds weird to say, if you look at Steve Winwood in that photo, he looks like me. It's fucked up.
Really?
Like it's one of these things where, like, from being a record store guy all these years, when I was like, I see it's used at every single record store. Every time I see it, it jars me because it's this one photo where you're like, oh my God, that could be me. But, like, you know, obviously many, many, many years ago.
Celebrity doppelganger. What a crazy one to have.
And honestly, it's the only photo of him that looks like that. The rest of the photos from, like, that same shoot, not so much, but that one photo is really fucked up.
Blind Faith, which, by the way, sounds like a band that could be on, like, the Sound and Fury lineup.
Oh, for sure.
That's, like, such a good band name. Yeah. That's you. That is 100% you.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? Isn't that fucked up? Like, I didn't even have to tell you which member it was. You just immediately saw it, right?
What a concept. Which one is Jeremy again? He's the one that looks like Steve Winwood in Blind Faith.
It's so fucked up. It's so fucked up.
That's funny.
Okay, sorry. I had to. No one's brought up Steve Winwood on the show, and I never had an opportunity to call that out. So
I love Steve Winwood, and that was the first record that Tom Lord Alge worked on, who's a famous mixer who also did like Mechanical Animals and Celebrity Skin, Hole in Marilyn Manson, lot of like Blink-182, Angels and Airwaves stuff. So I met him at NAMM a few years ago, and I'm sure people just go up to him and fan about all these huge modern records. And I'm like, I got to talk to you about two things. That crazy drum loop at the beginning of Higher Love on the Steve Winwood record.
Yeah.
And the snare drum sound on Marilyn Manson's Mechanical Animals. I need to know about both. And he was so just taken back. Like, someone's asking me two questions I've never really heard. But
oh, sure. Cool. Did you get good answers?
No, not at all. He doesn't remember. He does. He smiled, took a picture with me, and that was it.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. What was the first album that you remember buying with your own money, or maybe was gifted to you that you specifically asked for?
First cassette. It was a cassette. Was a Sheryl Crow Tuesday Night Music Club.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, that was a big one. That was first cassette. First CD was Cardigan's First Band on the Moon.
Wow. Okay. So you found your you had a vibe. You aimed for the women fronted, like singer songwritery or band led sort of thing. It seems like,
yeah, it's probably not a good thing to say in public when I'm trying to run a business and, you know, be a full time producer out here. But just the sound of the male voice has never been one of my favorites.
Sure.
I think it's just the melodic options that you get out of female singers is something my ear has always been drawn to since I was a little kid. So that, I mean, every single one I've named to you so far, aside from Steve Winwood, who's you know, yourself. they've all been female singers just because I love what they could do with their voices. To this day, most of the music I listen to, it's a lot of female singers, but.
Right.
Yeah, that Sheryl Crow record that cassette was a huge one for me being, I think, about 8 years old when I bought that.
Is that the one that has all the main hits?
All I Want to Do is
All I Want to Do.
All I Want to Do is Have Some Fun, Leaving Las Vegas, that one.
Yeah. Huge karaoke hits.
But really hard to sing. I still try to sing My Favorite Mistake every time I do karaoke, and there's midway through, I'm always regretting it.
Wow, and you've got a really nice voice, so that shows the range.
Her range is up there.
So what about your first concert? What was the first concert you went to?
That would have been Linda Ronstadt. Yeah, when I was, you know, when my mom was touring with her at the, what was called, I believe it was the Blockbuster Pavilion back at the day, or the Blockbuster Amphitheater, which became the Glen Helen. Do you remember that in San Bernardino?
Yes, yes.
It was Linda Ronstadt.
Ozfester too. Out there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That would have been there. So it was Linda's Canciones de Mi Padre tour, which my mom was a featured dancer on that. So I remember her getting back from tour. She was out for maybe 2 months touring the country with Linda on that tour. And my uncle took me to go see her. And I have all these photos of me like backstage. And that was my first real concert. That was a big one.
Had your mom done touring before that? Or was that the first time that she had done? Okay.
She had done a few. Linda was her first experience with actual touring. But that was all. She probably started around 87 or 88 with her. And I think the first concert I went to was 89 or 90 even.
Okay. And because I'm just a dumbass white guy, I had read that you also at some point were doing the same kind of dancing as her. So, and I have it written out here, but it's I have it as folklorico, but you say it much better than me.
Folklorico. Yeah. You're close.
Okay.
Folklorico. Yeah.
So you mentioned she was doing that. You also were doing that for a while?
When I was real little, it was just one of those things, you know. I'm sure if I grew up in my dad's household, it would have been full-time music lessons. But since I was with my mom, it was folklorico classes and the Aztec dancing. So, you know, I was like a little like four-year-old in a loincloth and a big feather headdress like loud drums doing the whole Alvera Street thing.
Yeah.
It's a cool foundation. It's a really cool rhythmic foundation to have as a kid in music. You know what I mean?
Oh, I bet.
I love being rooted in dancing before music. Not that I kept it up, but it just made for a cool rhythmic sensibility, I think.
Could you still cut a rug like that? What's up?
Of course. Yeah, totally. Of course. I don't get the opportunity too often. So if anyone out there is having a quinceañera anytime soon and needs some extras.
You know, I know you're a multi-instrumentalist. So what was the first instrument you started to play?
I definitely had one of those kids' keyboards. You know, I think everyone has the little Casio keyboard when they're a kid.
Like the sick-ass built-in.
Yes.
Loops. Yeah.
Exactly. It, like, preset 2 is always funky clav, which I still don't know what that is. After this many years as working in a studio, I don't know what a funky clav is. But, trying to play along to some of those, like, Paula Abdul synth leads on that thing. I vividly remember that. Had a violin when I was really young.
I didn't know that.
There was a lot. They were kind of just tossed at me because whenever I would see my dad, it's like, cool, here's an instrument. You know what I mean? So the trumpet was the first real instrument I took lessons on.
Oh, okay.
So I played trumpet full time for, I want to say, about 3 or 4 years.
How old are you at this point?
Probably between like 9 and 12, I would say.
Okay.
Because I played it in middle school. So, like, I was in the band in my middle school in 7th and 8th grade playing trumpet. I took lessons from this, like, jazz trumpet player. And in the background, my dad was on tour, and he knew I took an interest to guitar because I bought, like, an acoustic guitar at a garage sale across the street from my house. And I learned the little guitar riff from Sheryl Crow, All I Want to Do Is Have Some Fun. I was, like, obsessed with guitar at that point. So he told my mom, hey, I'm bringing him an electric guitar next time I visit. And she says, and I quote, if you do that, he's never going to play the trumpet again. Like, trust me, I know where his head's at right now. He's not going to want to do trumpet anymore. He's like, no, he'll do both. Don't trust me. He'll do both. And no, he brought me an electric guitar. It was done. You know,
what kind of guitar was it?
Classic Fender Squire Affinity pack. You know, it's just the black and white Strat with the little matching amp and the strap and comes with like 3 picks. So it was that, and, you know, my uncle took me to Guitar Center to get whatever tab books I wanted. So I got Green Day Nimrod, and I got Pumpkin Siamese Dream, the tab books.
One of those is harder than the other.
Much harder than the other. Again, great foundational, you know, that's a great foundation for learning, because I got to learn the power chords from the Green Day record. And then the Siamese Dream book, which I still have, it just had chapters about, like, tone and playing guitar. I wasn't even really looking at the tabs. It just said, like, oh, cool. Like, here's how Billy got the guitar sound on Cherub Rock. Here's how you tune down half a step. It just had cool info that I don't think other 12-year-olds were really getting, you know?
I was about to ask, is that, I mean, I definitely own some tab books, but I just would have flipped to the pages with the, you know, with the shitty power chords. Was that common in those tab books? I can't remember, to like describe how to get sounds, because that sounds like
I don't
very
think
Billy
so
Corgan thing to have included.
It is, But that, yeah, it is. I don't remember ever seeing that in any of the other tab books I had. It's the melancholy book, which I, you've probably seen. It's sitting here in my control room. Yeah. It has the same thing. It has like, these are the tones for this. Here's how you hook up these pedals together to get this particular sound.
Have you, did you implement any of that ever? And is like, is totally. It factual?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I'm from the, I subscribe to the Church of Billy Corgan, which right. for better, for worse, you know, whatever that means. But yeah, I've tried copycatting so many of those sounds, but it was cool. That was a cool foundation to build my early guitar skills off of. It wasn't just power chords. It was learning how to mimic his leads, you know?
Right.
And that was really important to me, especially growing up with my mom listening to stuff like Santana, because people might not think it, but to me, like, they have very similar guitar solo styles because they kind of sing with their guitars, and it could be kind of gentle and beautiful. And I thought that was cool. So I've always been more into like the feel of guitar playing rather than like the shredding aspect of it.
Right.
And that Siamese Dream book really shaped that, like, especially a song like Mayonnaise, like it had the tabs for the two layers in the beginning. So, you know, learning both of those and
that
how they work
all,
together.
Did that all like make sense to you right away? And were you taking any guitar lessons, or was it just like, here's a guitar, here's some tablature, have fun?
That's all it was. Yeah, I've never taken a guitar lesson. So it was all learning that by ear. And once in my own head, I invented multi-track recording, which I think every kid does when they figure out how to hack a karaoke machine. But once I figured out how to start multi-tracking those tab parts I was learning, I would record, you know, the opening riff of Mayonnaise, and then put the cassette in deck B, put a new cassette in deck A, press record on deck B, and now you're multi-tracking. I'd play the lead over it, play it back, and be like, that's both parts. Like, you know, this is how he did it.
And you just kind of like figured out how to do that? Or did you have anyone telling you like,
no,
oh,
not at
probably...
all.
Wow. Yeah. Innovation. Just I didn't out have of desperation.
Yeah. I didn't have any, my uncle is an amazing guitarist, but I didn't spend a lot of time around him. I didn't have anyone in my immediate like vicinity that was a guitar player at all in my household. So that was all just trial and error, figuring it out and, you know, starting my own bands when I was 12 years old and being like, all right, guys, this is how we do this.
And you're, you know, you're someone who can sing really well. One of the, you know, I think one of your secret weapons is your ability to have like perfect pitch, basically. Were you singing at a really young age?
Not at all. I didn't sing. I didn't sing in a melodic way until I want to say about 2010.
For Silver Snakes?
Yeah. That was the first band I ever like sang in like a melodic way for at all. You know,
interesting.
I was always really, really self-conscious and shy about singing. And my, you know, in that scene in Step Brothers where they're singing Sweet Child of Mine in the car?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? That's kind of like how it was, like with my dad as a kid. You'd be out in public and he'd be like, all right, guys, three-part harmony. Like, you do this, you do this, you do this. And I was always horrified because I'm just like, this is weird. Like, just, I have a sense of shame.
Did you do it?
I don't remember ever really doing it. You know what I mean? I just remember being weird and awkward about it. And just always being like,
rebellious kid, just like, I'm not doing this.
Not even like that. Just like, I'm not cool enough to do that. Cause you know, I think we grew up in that same era where the musicians we looked up to or, you know, saw on stage were rock stars. They were larger than life rock stars. And that's very different once you kind of get into like a punk or hardcore subculture. Everyone's kind of on the same playing field at that point. But to me, looking up to people like Billy Corgan and Trent Reznor and Silverchair when I was a kid, it was like, these are like super cool, like from outer space, superhuman talents, you know? I'm like, I'm just some little like chubby Mexican kid from East LA. Like, I can't be doing this. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I never tried to sing. And then I was, you know, doing like heavy vocals. I was in that band Cathedrals for like 5 years and just screaming my brains out. And then after that, when it was time to do something new, it's like, okay, let's see if this is a thing that works. And I got super embarrassed about it. And
all right, so listen, there are no shortage of record labels out there. So if I was asked who I think stands out above the rest in quality and consistency, it's Convulse Records. Starting in only 2019, they have been completely unstoppable. You know them from releasing records by Gel, MS Paint, and Military Gun. Well, they've just released two new 7-inches, one by the Tokyo hardcore band The Breath, and the other by Ultras, who features members of World Peace and Fentanyl. You can check out those records along with all the other top tier releases by visiting convulserecords.bandcamp.com. And if you want a personal recommendation, check out the Daisy release, Maximum Blast Super Loud. Past guests of the podcast, great band. Or how about Entry? Their latest 7-inch Exit interview is incredible. And hey, it features Clayton from Touche Amore, and I swear I'm not being biased. Hit up convulserecords.bandcamp.com. One of the most commonly asked questions that I get is, where can I get merch printed? Well, I've got an answer for you. It's Anchor Fish Printing. They are a one-stop merch shop, and if you place an order and mention the First Ever Podcast, you will get free shipping on your order to anywhere in the country. My bands have worked with the owner, Michael, for years, and he even printed the First Ever Podcast merch. I wouldn't trust anyone else to do it. They can handle all your merch needs, from clothing to patches to banners, posters, stickers, you name it. And again, mention the First Ever Podcast and get free shipping on your merch order anywhere in the country. So visit anchorfishprinting.com, place your order, mention the podcast. Done deal. What was the first song that you remember learning how to play, maybe on guitar, we'll say that, that you were like, oh fuck, like I can actually do this? And did it come quick?
It was probably that Sheryl Crow song, that All I Want to Do Is Have Some Fun, because I have a very like vivid memory of this. You know, everyone has that classical beater guitar when they're a kid, so it's just this thing's falling apart, nylon strings, garage sale, out of tune, and I learned that little da 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 da, super easy little riff that comes in the chorus, and it like unlocks something basically in my brain that said, wait, you can listen to music and you can isolate parts in the song without technology at all, you know what I mean? And that's a really useful skill, especially at such a young age, to be able to just focus on a drum part, just focus on a bass part or guitar part. So once I learned that, I felt like I was able to listen to anything and just isolate the part I was trying to learn. The Cardigans, that was another one, how I said that CD, First Band on the Moon. The first song on that record, it's called Your New Cuckoo, has like this really cool bass line. And I just felt like I had this noise-canceling feature in my brain that could shut everything off except for that bass line to where I could learn it. And that, you know, that gave me the confidence to pursue guitar as an instrument, or, you know, bass as an instrument, or anything in that realm.
What about, so when did you start your first band? You mentioned having a bunch of bands when you were a kid. So like, what was the first like one that actually had a band practice?
My first bandnamegenerator.com experience, that would have been seventh grade with my band Dysfunctional Envy.
Was it genuinely a band name generator?
bandnamegenerator.com. Yep. You know, we went through a lot of like High Voltage and, you know, those kind of band names when you're like 11 or 12 and they all just sound
so badass. Dysfunctional Envy.
And yeah, that was my first band in seventh grade.
Okay. So talk to me about Dysfunctional Envy.
Dysfunctional Envy. It was just me and a neighbor and one other kid at my school. I played guitar. My neighbor Abraham played bass. And our friend Ryan, his parents got him a drum kit. And we would meet up at Ryan's house and I would bring over, we actually wrote songs. So I would bring over a song that I wrote. They all just sounded like Silverchair ripoffs of stuff off Freak Show or Frog Stomp. And we would learn that. We learned Smashing Pumpkins covers. And then when we were all in the middle school band orchestra. And it was time for the winter concert. And the band teacher knew we were in this band together. And he asked if we wanted to perform between the two halves of the concert. So it's like orchestra, which is brass. And then we played two songs, a Smashing Pumpkins cover of Cherub Rock and an original. And then the strings, you know, that group played after. So that was like my first taste of performing, you know, given I was wearing like a uniform, a suit and tie, and playing in front of a bunch of parents in a school amphitheater.
What was the original like? What did it sound like? Was it an attempt at Smashing Pumpkins? Or was it like a mix of the three things that you guys were all into separately?
I could probably still play it. It sounded exactly like the Silverchair song Abuse Me, which is on Freak Show.
Yeah.
It was just a ripoff of that. The classic, like, here's the clean verse, here's this distorted chorus, clean verse, distorted chorus. There's no vocals. I didn't want to sing.
Right.
Awesome, probably. It's funny because looking back on it, the things available at that time, it's the kind of stuff that people would probably think is super cool now. Like my rig, I had a Sun amp and a Big Muff. Like that was it. That was my setup. I had my Fender plugged into a Sun Beta 112 and a Big Muff.
In junior high?
This was seventh grade.
Dude,
yeah,
you had a Sun amp and a Big Muff in junior high?
Because the Sun amp is what was at the local music store for cheap and was used. No, you know, it wasn't cool yet.
I just love how cool that all is.
Yeah, and the Big Muff, it was the black Russian Big Muff because I read in the Pumpkins tab book that that's how you get that pumpkin sound, is a Big Muff.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
No tuner pedal, you know, God forbid I'm in tune. Which now I would never, you know, it's what I spend my days criticizing people for now, but yeah.
Man, that's really, really wild. By the way, just as an aside, I recently was revisiting Frog Stomp. Those songs are fucking long on that record.
How about those lyrics, huh?
Dude, but like, when I was like, oh, maybe I'll play one of the singles, like Tomorrow or like Pure Massacre, Israel Sun. The songs are all like 6 minutes long. I'm like, Jesus
so
Christ.
So long. But what a reflection of being that age and writing songs. Like, you know, you don't know the rules when you're that young.
You don't know when to stop. Yeah.
Yeah, you just smash a bunch of parts together, which is crazy because the producer they had on that was like, it was Nick Lanay, who's like, he's an amazing producer. But I think he was just like, I'm going to let these kids do their thing. They're talented. I'm just going to, you know, shape it into what it is.
Yeah. I might be exaggerating with some of those. I need to revisit this because I do feel like I looked at that and I was like, oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Israel Sun 518. Tomorrow's 430. That's not too bad. Pure Massacre.
For a radio
is five
single.
Minutes. Yeah, exactly.
Dude, Tomorrow was all over K Rock when we were kids.
Dude, totally.
That's a long song.
Yeah.
What is
good record.
That record doesn't, that one doesn't hold up for me as well as Freak Show does, but.
No, I agree.
It's good.
When I was listening to some of the other tracks on it, I was, because I definitely had that CD. I was, usually if it's a record that was like in my, you know, my brother and I were swapping it back and forth or something, if I haven't listened to it in 30 years, there's times where like I have it on and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember this part. I remember all these parts. I was not remembering most of anything.
Really?
other than just the singles. Yeah.
Because you'd be like, oh, I remember this part. Wait, that's a Pearl Jam song I'm remembering. Oh, I remember this part. That's a Stone Temple Pilots song I'm remembering.
They were
lifting pretty liberally from their influences on that one.
Totally.
But
totally.
It was cool.
Yeah,
because you'd see them in the magazines and you're like, dude, these kids, I mean, they're probably,
they
you're only
maybe
like two,
whatever.
Exactly. They're probably your age, maybe a year or two older than you. You're only like 2 years older than me, but they were, you know, I was 12 reading that Daniel Johns was 15. It was blowing my mind that these kids were on a stage like that with his wall of Soldano amps, goals, and they just look so cool.
I always remember one of them always wore a Tool shirt. That was the thing I remember.
The bass player.
Might have been the bass player. Was always rocking the Tool shirt. And I was like, man, he's different.
He knows. He's all.
Okay, so that was the first show you played, right? So what was the first? So this is where things start to get fun because of obviously your career. What was your first time ever recording? Like, not obviously with your karaoke machine, but like an actual going to a studio.
Oh, so someone recording me.
Yes.
You mean? Yes. My first experience with that is probably, man, that I did play guitar. I played acoustic guitar on one of my dad's songs at a studio called Interface Studios, which is still there. It's in Pico Rivera, California. And he was doing a record for his mariachi group called Tequila con Limón. And there's a song on the record called Chapala, which is, that's where my family's from, Chapala in Mexico. And my little sisters were singing on it, and I guess he wanted the whole family to be a part of it. So he brought me in. I played this little lead guitar line on it. Super simple, super intimidated. This, you know, this little kid with my $200 acoustic guitar in front of like a 40,000 U47 microphone.
And you used like the $200 guitar?
Oh, yeah. It was just what I had. It was like a steel string Washburn acoustic that had like flame stickers on it that I put on it.
Yeah.
And
I guess I would have just assumed maybe that you would have been handed a nicer guitar for that session. Wow.
I think that they wanted the sound of a steel string, and mariachi music is traditionally nylon string. So it was just cool. Just bring yours. And it's cool. I mean, the song's on Spotify still, and that record got nominated for a Latin Grammy. So my first time recording was on a Latin Grammy nominated record, which is pretty awesome.
Flex.
There was that. And with my own band, you know, going into high school, that's when you you go in with your own tastes and you meet people around you that kind of shape them into whatever else. So I just wanted to play guitar in a band and I didn't care what it was. And obviously I wanted to do the Pumpkins grungy thing, but like most kids that go to school in East LA or whatever, there's two branches. You're either like, you're either dressed like the Misfits and only playing classic rock, or you're like into pop punk or crust punk. You know what I mean? That was it.
Yeah.
It's just different levels of stench. And, so it's like, oh God, like, what do I do? Where do I go? And I love the stuff the crusty punk kids were into, and that shaped some of my tastes. And I couldn't get into any of the like classic rock or the Misfit stuff the other kids were into. But I met one kid that was like, hey, you play guitar? I need a guitarist for this show that we're playing. It was in May of 2000. He's like, it's going to be here at our high school. It's called Pax Americana. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I'll play for you. Like, give me a mix of what songs you want. Because they were covers, he said. And this was the entry into my world of the Lord, We Lift Your Name Up High scene. So he gave me a cassette that had MXPX, 238, Starflyer 59, the OC Supertones, wow, and Slick Shoes. So I had to learn all these. My first time ever hearing anything remotely close to what would be deemed pop punk, right?
Oh my God.
I'm like horrified. Like, what is, like, why are these people singing like this? Like, there's no riffs. This is all palm muting. I was like mad about it. Like, how dare you ask me to do this? Which is kind of my attitude now sometimes. But
yeah,
I learned it and it was cool because I got to learn a different style. And my first real show that wasn't, you know, playing to high school parents was that show at my high school in May of 2000, opening for Slick Shoes, which is nuts because I'm working on their record right now. 24 years later.
Are we allowed to spoil that full circle moment? Oh my God.
Yeah, we've all posted stuff about it. So yeah, I'm doing a record with Slick Shoes right now, which I had to tell them, like, hey, just so you guys know, my first real show was opening for you guys at my high school in 2000.
Right.
Yeah. So, and that was it. You know, that was my first time seeing, you know, like a punk band on stage. And the other opener for that show was, you know, remember the Caffeines?
Oh, yeah.
Which was, yeah, so that, you know, a Bleeding Kansas adjacent band for all of us old folks from the Southern California area. They opened that show as well. So that was the day I met them. It's the day I got to see Slick Shoes, and that was just it. So that sent me on that path of playing distorted rock music with other people and ended up in a local studio called True One Recording in Whittier and did a live demo there. And it was cool. It was a really cool experience. And of course, it's the kind of thing that going forward, getting into recording, it's like, cool. I know I never want to give young kids that same experience they gave me, which was also my experience at Love Juice, which I know you've been there too.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, I went there when I was 16, I recorded at Love Juice, and it was like, cool. I don't ever want to put anyone else through this experience, what they're doing to my band.
Man.
Which it's,
I was curious.
Everyone our age has a Love Juice experience.
Yeah. Is that place still around?
It is. I think the original in Riverside is still there. Is that where you guys recorded?
We did the demo there.
In Riverside?
Yeah.
Okay, so that one's still there.
Yeah. We have the classic story of Nick tracked the first song with like his bass amp. And then,
yep.
And then, then after that, they're like, it's too loud. You're going to have to go direct for the rest of it. So that's why the bass sounds good only on track one.
Yep. Yeah, and then Nick just had to go overkill when we did the LP right after that, and he's like, hey, the first guy didn't let me use an amp, so now I'm going to use two.
Oh my God.
I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember that, but that's really funny. Holy shit.
Oh, so, yeah. Nick had two bass stacks on the first record.
With, you just mentioned the Caffeines, which I figured would come up at some point. So, like, you know, they, I feel like, in a way, are kind of almost like a Venn diagram of, like, maybe you and I being around each other
or something
like that, because they were a band that, because of Bleeding Kansas, who you also just mentioned, they were friends, and, you know, like, I think just going to see them play is probably how we cross paths. But I saw that the singer Nacho had recorded the Caffeines, or sorry,
yeah,
not Caffeines, had recorded Cathedrals, your old band.
Yeah. Yep.
Was that?
That was after the Caffeines days. I mean, Nacho was the guy that recorded everyone in the San Gabriel Valley back in the day. So, I mean, he did like a lot of cool bands. He did End on End. He did like, I don't think he did Bleeding Kansas, but he did the Jackson 9, which was like members of Bleeding Kansas and the Caffeines, if you remember them.
Yeah, I remember having the Burn CD of that, which I would love to fucking hear right now. Like, I feel like that shit was really good. It was like one song that was like 10 minutes long or something, right?
9 minutes, and it was called The Legend of Sleepy Hollowville, which was like a family fun center that who's the What You Talk About Willis guy?
Gary Coleman
was like the spokesperson for this like family fun center called Sleepy or called like Hollowville or something, and that's what that 10-minute song was about. But
oh my god,
yeah. Anyway, so Dave Watrous, who was a guitarist for Bleeding Kansas, was originally in the Caffeines, and when he left the Caffeines, he started Bleeding Kansas. So that was the crossover. And I know that, you know, my high school band, it was a hardcore band called After Silence, played with your old band, Stricken, and we played together at the Santa Anita Inn in Arcadia. And I think it might have been with the Caffeines. And that was, I think, the first time we played a show together and met.
Oh, my God. I have no recollection of...
Yeah, I totally remember it.
That. Wow.
And I mean, that's how I met you. That's how I met the band Winterdale Calls back then. And
oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your guitarist, the guitarist from Stricken, Brian Espinoza, which was a dude from my high school. So I was a freshman, he was a senior, and everyone's like, he joined this cool hardcore band. And we all went to see you guys once, and it's like, oh my God, they have riffs. They're heavy.
Wow. So. Yeah. Wait, so would you sort of point to Nacho from the Caffeines as like someone who sort of like showed you early ropes of like how to record specific ways? Because obviously
definitely.
He's a close friend, yeah, and he recorded your bands.
Yeah, definitely. And he had such a particular style. He had that classic like Phil Spector, like analog tape, everything's analog on the way, and getting these raw sounds, you know what I mean? And this is early 2000s.
Pulling guns on the people he's recording.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I learned a lot from him. He did the Cathedrals record. He did the first After Silence record, and those were all to analog tape. And then I brought him in to do, well, actually, the first record I produced that I have a producer credit on is for this band called Orangeburg Massacre. And this was in 2006. It was on Pluto. It was a Pluto Records release,
yes,
I think.
That's Thriller toured with them.
Did you really?
Yes, we did.
I didn't know that.
Tour with them. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
First band I ever produced.
Oh, my God.
That's wild. I had no idea. And Nacho engineered that because we did it to tape. And then Mike Watts, who'd done like all the Hopes Fall stuff and a bunch of Glassjaw stuff, mixed it. So the first like producer credit I have was mixed by this dude who's done like some of my favorite records.
Oh my God.
And that was all via Nacho. So then, you know, years down the line, whenever a band wanted to do stuff to tape, it was cool bringing Nacho, like Joyce Manor. When, you know, I work with Joyce Manor, we brought Nacho in to do all the engineering for the analog tape portion of that self-titled album.
How did you know the Orangeburg Massacre guys? Were they from your area?
No, they were from South Bay, and we were from a totally different area, but it was just that hardcore band I was in high school, After Silence, played a lot of shows, and we definitely crossed paths with them at one time. And you know, the hardcore scene in Southern California was so split between like you were either kind of beat down or you were into the real like artsy angular stuff.
Uh-huh.
So it's like all of us that were in, it's like you were either into like Throwdown or you were into like Breathe Resist and Converge. You know what
yes.
I mean?
Yes.
So we were on that side of things, or yeah. You know, all those like The Smell. It was all the Bleeding Kansas adjacent stuff.
Yes,
they would play
totally.
With all those Power and the Glory and all, like Gospel and all like the really cool Breathe Resist angular hardcore bands. So I think all of us kind of met up back then, and that kind of put all those friendships in motion.
Man, I really hope that that's a sound that kind of gets a reboot one of these years. Like, we just need one cool band from, you know, around here to do that. So I feel like Sarah's new band has like some elements of that.
Do they?
Sarah G's new
cool.
band.
Awesome.
But yeah, like I would love to just hear a band come out of nowhere and be like, we're influenced by Breathe or Resist, and be like, fuck
yeah.
Because like, what an era, what a band, what a just live performance kind of a thing. Like, and I feel like so many of us took such huge inspiration from even those bands live, where like you would go see them play, they'd play on the floor, they would have floodlights
in the dark.
Underneath the drums. Yeah, it would just be floodlights.
Yeah. Were you at the Coup show when it was them and Plot to Blow Up the Eiffel Tower? And they, this, It was in the back room at Coos in Long Beach. It wasn't on a stage.
I tell this story all the time.
Do you? The one light bulb in the ceiling.
Yes!
And right when they were about to go on, he like got up on a chair and unscrewed the single light bulb. So everyone's pitch black, right? They open up with the first song off Charmer.
Yeah.
It's that which just drums. And as soon as the guitars kick in, Evan Patterson, who went up to do Young Widows and J-Jail, steps on a button, and they had those Trainer column speakers filled with floodlights that none of us knew were there. And the room just flashed you with these lights. And I think it just changed everyone's. All of us were all of a sudden, we had handlebar mustaches and cowboy shirts on. And, you know, all of a sudden, all the riffs turned into pull-offs on Telecasters.
Oh,
it just changed everything for that room, I think.
Yes, it was like pitch black, and I remember kids were holding it because it was pre, you know, iPhones or anything like that. So kids are like holding up their Nokia phones to try to see. I'll never forget the vocalist saying, "Turn off your cell phones. You'll appreciate our theatrics." And I was like, "What does that mean? I can't see a foot in front of me. Like I can't pitch black in there." And then all of a sudden, just da 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 da.
Yeah. Where does that come from? You know, like I can't even describe a band like that to people because it just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Because that their sound was like it's like the Jesus Lizard meets Converge or something like that. You know what I mean? It's very rooted in bass and drums.
Yeah.
The guitars just float over and everything. And the vocalist kind of has a classic, like screamy hardcore voice, but it was awesome. Were you at the Smell show too, when it was them, Cursed, Hope Conspiracy?
You fucking bet your ass I was.
And same thing. They had a wall, you know, they didn't have this at that Coos show, but they had a wall of amps and I had never seen that before. And
what
it was
an
just
era,
that,
man.
What an era, right?
We were talking about that at Touche Practice, like at some point within the last year, where I was like, man, I think of a band like Lords, these bands that would tour with like three full stacks, and these poor bastards would be loading that into basements. You're just like,
dude,
why?
Guy from Lords had a cab with like 18 speakers in. Did you see them in Daniel Pouliot's garage when they played in his garage?
Dude, probably. Like,
yeah, they played like in the garage next to like his parents' pool, and this dude had a Gibson cab that was like 10 feet wide by like 6 feet tall.
Oh my God.
And they were a three piece, you know?
Yeah.
And that fell out of vogue for some reason, but that style of music was so cool. I wouldn't
tell
even
you why.
Know
how, like, what a pain in the ass way to tour.
Right.
I mean, just the worst. Yeah. When let's be honest, a fucking a twin reverb can get pretty fucking loud too.
You imagine a band today that sounded like Breathe the Resist that just has like line six Helix like floorboards and they're just like it's okay guys.
Yeah,
you know,
we got
a pod.
Yeah,
we got it. Plug me in direct.
I mean, this is probably skipping ahead quite a bit, but what was the first release that was like an official release? Like you had, like maybe you got it on vinyl kind of a thing.
Of something I did or
yeah, something
what do you,
you
mean?
Did. Something you played on.
Like that I played on.
Like you were like one of your bands.
Vinyl was way later. Vinyl wasn't until Cathedrals. So
yeah.
Cathedrals, we did a split with Bleeding Kansas. And that was my first ever thing on vinyl, on Melotov. So
right.
It was that Cathedrals split. And then probably right after that is a split we did together, Cathedrals and Deadhead, the 7-inch.
Yeah.
Those were the first ones where it's like, whoa, someone's investing, you know, vinyl was like the dark arts when you're a kid. So it's like someone's investing this much money into vinyl for us. And I still have like 200 copies of that, Cathedrals record if anyone's interested. That was probably the first one. Yeah.
The
BK split. I have so many of those.
Man, talk about
neither
like,
of us were very active. That was the tail end of their career and we never toured. So, you know, we just sat with a stack of those things with nowhere to sell them.
Man, when you have a record that does not perform as well as you hoped, it's one of these things where it feels like an extra burden, because not only is it taking up space, but it's also extremely heavy, but you can't throw them away. You just don't have the heart to do it, you know?
Nope, you can't do it. And I have like a box of 500 Silver Snake CDs in my garage. That's like, what am I gonna do with CDs, you know?
Yeah. How... I don't know if I know this. How soon after Cathedrals did you start Silver Snakes? And was there ever a band between that maybe I'm forgetting about?
At one point, I was also playing in a band called Polygraph, which was with the guys from the Caffeines.
That's right. And that was kind of like a Cursed-y sort of band as well, right?
No, it was like it was like an instrumental like rock band. I don't even know how to describe it, but
wrong. I think I probably assumed it was Cursed because that's a Cursed song title.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a band had riffs. It was just cool, like open tuning, big riff. The drummer from the band, Eddie Mosqueda, who was the drummer for Cathedrals and the Caffeines, wrote all the music. Dude's a musical genius.
Were you guys doing
genius.
Like a Russian Circle sort of a thing? Like that kind of a vibe?
It was probably more rooted in like things like Tortoise and like seaweed.
And
they really liked the sea and cake and a lot of like indie stuff, but also mixing in their really heavy influences. But some of it almost, you know, put it this way, my mom liked it. Like it was like parent-friendly instrumental rock that had the occasional like huge riff.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I played with them for a while, and I was doing that in Cathedrals at the same time. And then, I mean, Cathedrals split up in 2010, and immediately I did Silver Snakes as like my main focus and just put everything into that.
And because I feel like Silver Snakes went through such a sonic change from like the very beginning to like where it ended up, when you started, what did you have a main goal with that band? And how do you think that changed over time?
I did. It was just basically the polar opposite of what Cathedrals was doing. Cathedrals was a band that was influenced by like Tragedy and Coalesce and His Hero Is Gone and those tastes, you know. I just wanted to sound like John Pettibone and Nine Iron Spitfire. That was like my main influence with that band. When it was time to do Silver Snakes, it's cool. Time to do something that sounds like Cave In or Recover or At the Drive-In and something that was just rock and fun and pulling from the influences of the people I was playing with. I got Daniel from Bleeding Kansas to play drums, which was like, cool. Now I'm in a band with my favorite drummer of all time. Cause all of us that got to watch Daniel when we were younger knew that he was like, who else would you get to be your drummer if you had like, you know, your dream lineup? He's like it. He's the best. Yeah.
I mean, when Touche started, it was like Z was basically Von's
mini Daniel.
Von's brand, Daniel Polia, like in the way it's like he's, I mean, I would never take anything away from Z's drumming. He's a fucking crazy good drummer, but like you felt the influence that he had from Daniel, you know?
But what's a better influence to pull from? Like anytime I've played drums, it's all like, cool, I'm going to try to play like Daniel. Do you remember a band called Werewolf with Robot Hands?
Yes.
From the Bay, their drummer had a lot of Daniel in his playing also. All of us did in that day.
Yeah.
So having Daniel,
and for people listening who are like, I don't know what you're talking about. This, I can't relate to this. Who is this Daniel person? Daniel Polia, like to describe his drum style, it's like someone who hits really hard with a lot of swagger, like just so much swing to what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But I think it was the intensity in which he hit the drums that I don't care how loud your amp was. The drums were going to be overpowering everything.
Yep. Imagine watching like early 1990s Dave Grohl play in a coffee shop. Like that was Daniel. Cause you know, it's one thing to like, say I hit the drums hard. My hands hit the drums hard. Daniel's leg hitting the kick drum was like a bullet to your chest.
Yes.
And like he cut through everything. That was the first band that made me want to care about like tone and sounding good live. And
because that's the other thing,
they
right?
balanced themselves.
Because the drums also were tuned so well. And I don't think any of us, at least no one in my friend group, knew how to properly tune drums. So not only is he hitting the drums so fucking hard and there's so much swing in what he's doing, the drums just sound so good too.
Incredible. And I mean, I think it sucks that kids can't go listen to that streaming anywhere, but I mean, you could find it on YouTube. Just go, you know, YouTube Bleeding Kansas 1859 or Dead Under Decor, and you could hear his style of drumming. I mean, he also played drums. He also played in my band, so he's on the first two Silver Snakes records, and then Horse the Band, he's on a couple of the Horse records too, and Ancestors. And I think BK, though, is where we all like really got to his unhinged drumming, like before he went to music school and really learned how to like harness all that power and focus it. We got to witness like pedal to the metal Daniel.
Yeah, absolutely. How was it playing with him originally, like out the gate? Like, was it hard not to kind of like expose your fandom for having him behind the kit with the riffs that you were playing and making up?
Not really, because it felt like, I guess an analogy I could put it is in like playing a video game and you get to design your character, you get to design your like your race car or whatever.
Sure,
it's like,
yeah.
I was fully aware of the tools that were in front of me at my disposal, you know, like knowing the musicians I'm in the room with, like the back of my hand. So it's not a matter of like writing a part and being like, I hope he could play this. It's I'm writing parts completely with his style in mind. So anything I wrote was what I wanted
Billy
to hear
Corgan
Daniel
over
play.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. but without taking all their instruments and redoing it as soon as they left for the most part.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was like the coolest part about working with Daniel, which is tough because musicians never want to really backtrack. And here I am in 2010 trying to get Daniel to do all the stuff I loved about his drumming in 2004.
Right.
So Daniel had grown so much as a musician already in that small time. To where it'd be like, cool, I really think you should do this and go into this kind of part. And Daniel's like, what about like a Roger Waters kind of like, if I did like a Pink Floyd, you know? Because he got you into like collecting records for the most part, right?
Yeah,
so, I mean, he has such an eclectic music taste.
Yeah.
So here I am just being like, cool, I'm trying to limit you to this one small like subgenre of rock music that's like Lack and Recover and this cool stuff no one's heard of. And he's like, well, I could do a lot more than that. But it was really influential playing in a band with him.
So talk to me about the first tour you ever did.
With that band or just in general?
Your first tour.
My first real tour was, well, I did like, you know, a little weekender with, I was playing in Orangeburg Massacre for a minute, filling in for them.
What?
I don't remember much about that. This was 2006 maybe.
Wow.
And I did like I did a West Coast tour with them playing bass. That was my first time ever leaving town.
Yeah.
And, it was cool. I remember playing, what was that venue in Central California? Was it in Roseville? Like the Underground in Roseville or Orangevale? It was in Orangevale.
Orangevale, which is like Sacramento, basically.
Yeah. So I remember playing there with them, playing like the typical DIY spots in Santa Cruz or whatever. And that was really cool. And after that, I mean, the next two tours I did was just as like a, you know, quote unquote, when you're a guitar tech, when you're 20 years old, it means you're just there to like tune the guitar and you're just there to hang out and carry stuff, really.
Yeah.
And that was with some good friends of mine, this band, like a metalcore band called Dear Life. And I guitar teched for them on a tour with Comeback Kid. And that was my first time like traveling the country.
Yeah.
So it was them, Comeback Kid, Crime and Stereo, and Cancer Bats.
Wow.
And getting a tour of the country, you know.
Very of an
era. Yeah, all over the place. Yeah, very of an era. It was Comeback Kid touring on Wake the Dead, which was really cool.
Oh, tight.
It was right when Andrew started singing. So that was my first, that's what got me hooked on touring. That was like, okay, I love being on the road. I wasn't playing. I really wanted to. And a month after that, same thing, went back on tour with them, this time, quote unquote, tour managing. And it was us out with Dillinger Escape Plan and The Bled. And, you know, that's another one, like cool, getting to see that every night. What could be more inspiring than watching Dillinger Escape Plan every single night?
My God,
and make you want to go home and start a band
that?
Of tours.
Like 2008 that was or something?
April of 2008, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't even know if I remember that happening. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was right. It was Dillinger touring on Ironworks. So it was with Gil Sharon playing drums, which was incredible. His first tour with them. Yeah, and it was The Bled, definitely at the tail end of The Bled. But man, just what a cool thing to be a part of was just those two tours. And then it was a couple years after that I was in Silver Snakes and we started doing the usual paying our dues, like let's book a tour that no one comes to, a West Coast. And then let's go to South by Southwest and hop on a quote unquote showcase that no one's going to be at 1 PM and doing that whole thing. And it wasn't until I think, we hooked up with that booking agent, Andy Rice, and our manager, Mark Vieira. We met both of them at the same time. And they're like, I think they wanted us to be like their West Coast. This is at the time when Balance and Composure and like Super Heaven and like that kind of thing was really taking, like rock bands were kind of coming back, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And I think they thought like, okay, let's jump on this. This could be our West Coast version of that thing. Even though our heads were in such a different, you know, our influences were, you know, we're in our own heads about everything. So we always want to be so different. And they put us on tour with Defeater and Rotting Out and 100th. So that was the first real Silver Snakes tour. Yeah. Which, you know, couldn't be more awkward opening for three like pulverizing heavy bands at Gilman on your first tour as a band. But and ending at Sound and Fury. That's where that tour ended.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Silver Snakes was the first band that you went international with, right?
Yeah, we went to Europe with Pianos Become the Teeth. That was our international first taste of that.
Yeah, and how was that for you?
It was amazing. I loved it. At that point, Daniel just left the band, which was a huge bummer. But our buddy Justin, who plays drums in Caspian, he played drums for us out there.
Okay.
And I love the Pianos guys so much. So, you know, getting to do that with them was so cool. And, you know, never thought music, especially Silver Snakes, felt like my baby. You know, those were songs that I very heavy handed in writing everything for that band. So feeling that, like, whoa, like stuff I was writing in my bedroom just has me here in Dresden, has me here in Bruges, like right. has me at this castle, you know, it's such a crazy feeling. And even the first time going to Canada on a tour, it's like, what? Like that. And that was an ongoing theme with, those are like the perils of being like the predominant songwriter in a band, is you get to bear the stress and weight of a lot of it. But at the same time, when you have those moments that feel incredible, you're like, whoa, like I wrote this song. You know, how did I end up here?
Yeah.
So, yeah, doing that with Pianos was cool, and making friends with those guys, which that's what got us. As soon as we came back, we did the tour with United Nations, which was two of those dudes from Pianos.
Right.
So, yeah, that kind of that sent us on the path of those few years, which was just nonstop. Wait, what? You're touring with who? Which, you know, I'll be the first to admit, we had like a crazy run of tours for a band that, like, you know, has like 500 listeners on Spotify today. We had a crazy run.
Do you want to know what my favorite record store is in this entire goddamn country? It's Wanna Hear It Records in Watertown, Massachusetts. You might say to yourself, what do I care? I live in Boise. I live in Fort Worth. I live in Los Angeles. What good does that do me? Well, I'll tell you. They have a fully operational web store that gets updated with incredible secondhand records every Wednesday. I myself have gotten into quite a bit of trouble every time they post what's available online. Not only are they very rare records, they are very reasonably priced. And if you have no interest in secondhand records at all, they also sell new records. And here's the exciting part. Listeners of the show get 10% off their orders. So if you check out, use the code FIRSTEVER, spelled together, one word, spelled out, FIRSTEVER, you get 10% off. And if you spend more than $100, you get free shipping. Head on over to wannahearitrecords.com and follow them on Instagram for updates. Username, wannahearitrecords. Looking for an extraordinary coffee? Look no further than Heartwork Coffee. With 8 years of excellence and proudly roasting in the vibrant city of San Diego, California, visit heartworkcoffeebar.com to explore a wide range of single origin and blended coffees to suit your taste preference. On a personal note, co-founder Rob Moran has played in so many bands that have inspired me personally, like Unbroken and Some Girls, for example, and it's been amazing watching Heartwork thrive all these years. The coffee is amazing, and I'm thrilled to support this company. Once again, visit heartworkcoffeebar.com to place an order. That is H-E-A-R-T, workcoffeebar.com. Of all of my friends, I feel like you have probably some of the wildest and funniest bad luck tour scenarios that are like, you could just regale people for hours with like the shit that you put up with or dealt with. But there's a comedy in the tragedy with all of it, to where you've always had a very good attitude about all of it. But I mean, like,
it's all, man,
thinking about like,
it's,
I mean, and it's, you know, it's up to you if you want to get into any of this, but I mean, like, the story of you guys getting your boxes of CDs when you're on tour with Coheed is one of the funniest fucking things I've ever heard in my entire life. I don't know if you want to tell that story.
I can totally. Yeah. But I think I'm at a point now, you know, I don't know how much you feel like this, but
okay.
When you're in it, and your band is real active and you have management and a booking agent, like sometimes there's voices in your ears telling you like, don't talk about that so much, or like, leave that one out. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of have to play the game sometimes.
Yeah.
At this point, I feel like my NDA is like expired. So I'm always so open about all this stuff because it's funny. It's funny to me. And it's cool because it gets me an insight that I get to give to young bands that have those hopes and aspirations to do big tours, to where I could tell them, cool, here's how you end up on a tour in front of this many people a night and how things could go wrong.
Yeah.
Because we had a lot of bad luck, but at the same time, like, those tours were huge. Because starting in 2015, that was the first one. We did a Coheed tour. That was the first big one we did in 2015. Then 2016, we did Coheed and Glassjaw, immediately followed by Bring Me the Horizon, immediately followed by Let Live, immediately followed by Korn.
Right.
Like, those were all in the same year. And then 2017, immediately on tour, Chevelle. Like, these were all, there wasn't a period where we weren't playing to at least 2,500 people a night for at least a year and a half. It's and
insane.
The Korn tour was like, we were playing to 10,000 people a night because it was arenas. So, and with that just comes all the reality of it. People would be like, you went on tour with Korn. How is it? It was cool. It was the greatest feeling in the world playing songs I wrote to that many people. I came back with no money. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
totally.
I was gone for a month. We made nothing. And, you know, we had to load in at 11 a.m. every morning and load out at 2 a.m. in a van we were driving ourselves.
It's like for people listening, it's like those kind of tours, you are having to drive very far between shows, like, because they're all on buses and semis and shit. So, like, for them, they could just go to sleep and then wake up in the city. But, like, for you, you're having to drive 12 hours after the show when you're loading out at 2 in the morning. And then
and
you
loading
have to,
in
what,
at 11 a.m.
It's fucked up to hear
11 a.m. And then your sound check is at like 6 p.m. And then you play at 7 and then you wait around all over again. I wouldn't trade it for the world. I mean, and that put us on all those. We did all the Wimmer festivals that year. So, I mean, I think it was close to 100,000 people we played to at Rock on the Range. You know what I mean? Like, I got to stand side stage and watch like some of my favorite bands of all time. I got to watch like Marilyn Manson. I got to watch Ministry. I got to watch, you know, all these people. I got to see the Deftones and Gojira and, you know, kind of rub elbows in that world and have people like, I think I've told you before, I always freaked out. My biggest starstruck moment was meeting Ricky Rackman, the host of Headbangers Ball. I met him at one of those festivals and I introduced myself because I was really freaked out that I was meeting a guy that was like in the November Rain music video. And, when I told him, like, hey, I'm here, I play in a band called Silver Snakes, and he goes, oh, I know who you are. Everyone's been talking about you backstage. I'm like, what? What are you?
Do you know that, speaking of United Nations, that he's related to Jonah Bayer?
Ricky Rackman's related to Jonah?
So this all just came to my attention in the last week.
Whoa.
So on the Mad Ebert episode, we talked about the November Rain music video.
Yep, I heard. Uh-huh.
Jonah Bayer, out of nowhere, texted me about Ricky Rackman in that video, right? He was like, he's like, my cousin Rick. And I was like, fucking stop the presses. I just said, wait, your cousin? And then he goes,
Richard Rackman.
Yeah. He's like, we just put this all together recently. And so he sent me a link. He had Vanessa, his sister, and they have a podcast, invited Ricky on the show. And they talk about it, how they realized that they were related much later in life.
Crazy.
How fucking crazy
is
that? It's really funny.
I love that.
Yeah. Full circle situation. Your old tour mates in the United Nations, Jonah Bayer.
Exactly.
Related to Ricky Rackman.
Related to Ricky Rackman, who I have a picture on my Instagram somewhere of like a selfie of me and Ricky, and I was freaking out that I'm like, how am I here? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was one of those moments. But
and I also felt extremely old because when I came into band practice, because I got the text at band practice, I was like, dude, Jonah Bayer's related to Ricky Rackman. Not a single member of my band knew who Ricky Rackman was.
It might be a deep cut. The first thing I asked him if he was the guy that jumped through the cake in the music video, and he was like, that wasn't me.
That wasn't him.
But that's all I could think about.
And that gets talked about in that.
Does it really?
Yeah. He was like, it wasn't me, but maybe I should change the lore.
I gotta listen to that now.
We didn't tell the story. So talk to me about what happened with
the Star Wars story.
So
this is just, man. So
you can leave out, you can leave out throwing people
under
the bus.
I'll leave out names and I won't throw people under the bus, but just that band, it started, you know, when you get harder and you're touring for so long and sometimes, this is another thing I'm very open about, it just doesn't click. It doesn't take off. My band, Silver Snakes had all the opportunities in the world. We were on the radio. We were on K-Rock for a while, and we had songs on the Midwest, and we were doing those big tours, but it still didn't click. We were a band. I mean, I know you know this term, like, we were a band's band. Other bands liked us and music industry people liked us, but we just didn't click with like a group of music fans. And you could attribute that to whatever. I always attribute it to us just like constantly changing. We'd like find a foundation, establish a sound, and I'd be like, cool, did that. Next record's electronic. Do it. All right, cool. Next record's a stoner rock record. And it's just, that's just me. So things were going, you know, you get older, band members can't take all that time off a tour anymore. We're getting fill-ins, and which is a nightmare in itself. So we had those situations where it's like a fill-in. We have to send him home because he didn't learn the songs. We have a guy like, oh, by the way, I can't get into Canada, so I have to find another guy to take over the rest of a tour. And that keeps happening. And I think it culminates with one of our records just not showing up in time for our record release tour that, you know, we were kind of forced into. Like, well, we can't give you a release date until you have a tour, you know, to promote it on. Cool. Here, we got one. It's a perfect fit. It's 6 weeks, US and Canada. All right, cool. 2 weeks before, hey, the records aren't going to be ready until you guys are like home for another 3 months. So we'll do CDs. Okay. So we end up with CDs, and they actually sell okay because we're on this kind of industrial tour where people and their, you know, like gas masks are still buying CDs. And we get towards like the tail end. We're in Montreal and we're running out of stock. And it's like, hey, man, can you go grab a box in the van? All right, cool. Got it. There's a line. We had just played. And we actually had a line of people wanting to buy our new CD. So we bring out the box. I pull out a box cutter and I open it up in front of a room of people, right? Everyone's hovering over me to buy the CD. And the first thing I pull out is a digipack of the Star Wars Force Awakens soundtrack that the label had sent us. Zero explanation. To this day, I have no idea why we got sent a box of Star Wars CDs in lieu of our own CDs.
And the box
we got
was
an
like,
apology.
The box was labeled like the Silver Snake. Like, it, by all means, this should have been the Silver Snake CDs, right?
So
like,
it should have been a Silver Snake.
Like, there was
CD,
no
yeah,
warning sign that you got sent the
there
wrong
no
thing
warning
until that
song.
Moment.
Until the moment in front of a room of people that all just pointed and laughed at us that we had just unveiled a box of Star Wars CDs. And I was kind of at my wit's end already, as one is after a five weeks on the road
in
the US.
Yeah.
And just like, I have like this vivid memory of like we were in wherever like the General Mills plant is in the Midwest. We were in that city.
Okay.
Or no, I don't remember. Wherever we were. And I remember like taking a walk by myself after our set and being like, what am I doing, man? Like this was so embarrassing. This tour isn't going good. And like doing the classic, like standing on a bridge, like reflecting on my life and then just catching a whiff of like the Lucky Charms coming out of this factory because it was like a cereal factory. And that kind of just like zooming me back into my consciousness and being like, oh God, all right, shut up. Just enjoy this for what it is. Like where else, how else would I end up in these situations? So after that, I kind of just took tour for like, it might be this funny thing. We might lose money. I have the privilege of being able to, you know, work for myself and leave for weeks on end. And that's just like how I tried to see it after that. And, you know, famously, like my band split up because of a canceled tour. We were set to go on tour with that band Filter, and we were going to open for them on their 20-year anniversary, the huge thing, you know. And the week the tour was supposed to start, they canceled the whole thing after never once posting or promoting it. And it was like, well, if this isn't like an appropriate nail in our coffin, that was our luck. But again, I don't look back on any of it with any like mal feelings or whatever, because I got all, who else gets that opportunity? I'm not going to look back and be like, I could have had it all. It's like, dude, I got to tour with Korn, you know, I got to tour Europe. I felt like I had it all at one point. And
you have always been somebody who has a very how do I want to say this? You're somebody who's always had like an extremely positive outlook, even if you're not feeling it on the inside. You know what I'm saying? And you are somebody that will always figure out a way to make something work and make sure that the people around you are comfortable. Because I've witnessed that a ton of times with working with you in studios and things like that. And I think that you probably, like, all of those learning experiences only added to like your problem solving and your motivators and things like that when it comes to working with bands in your recording environment, you know? And like, I think you are a great person for giving advice. And I think you've always been in one way or another. So, you know, though these things didn't work out, you have a lifetime full of memories and experiences that I'm, as you mentioned, like you wouldn't trade them for the world. So,
yeah,
you know, and now you get to take all of that and just, you know, pass the information along to all these new bands and things like that, which is wonderful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be old man, like shaking his fist at the clouds. I'm not going to be one to be like, I could have had it all. You know what I mean? Because again, what luck to be even given those opportunities in the first place.
Totally.
You know what I mean? So like, you know, getting to hear a song I wrote on K-Rock, like nothing will ever change that feeling for me. It was so cool.
Totally.
And that's like, you know, bucket list. So, yeah.
All right. So, let's talk about recording stuff. Cause I feel like, you know, that's a thing a lot of people are really familiar with and I'm excited to talk to you about it. So like the first question I wanted to ask you about when it comes to recording is, do you remember the first time you noticed production on a record, like something that caught your ear as different when listening to a record where you're like, oh, like I can tell the significant sonic change in this and it feels special?
It was early on. Same how I touched on being able to separate like instruments in a recording when I was young, being able to hear certain parts. I think that also lends itself into the sonic qualities of recording as well. One I really remember that's pretty funny is the Spin Doctor song, Two Princes.
Okay.
It's like their most famous song, right? And I always remember the guitar solo on that record when I was a kid jumping out at me and being like, whoa. Like, I noticed the automation, like the volume jump in the guitars and how the solo, because it's kind of like a two-part solo, was kind of panned left and right. And, you know, where you wear your Walkman headphones when you're a kid. So really early on noticing panning, where a guitar was on the left side, a guitar on the right side, hearing the way, like, when there'd be a drum solo, the toms would move from left to right or right to left. That was something I was really conscious of. And then going into the Smashing Pumpkins work, and again, back on those tab books, reading that on a song like Soma, it says, the tab book says there's over 40 guitar overdubs in the song Soma. And having that in the back of my head and trying to sit there and differentiate all those parts, and that it kind of normalized that overkill production thing to me at a young age, where I just thought, oh, that's how you're supposed to do things. Like, things are supposed to be in big layers, like texture is so important. So learning those parts of the recording process was really cool. And I think it's the Pumpkins records. Those are the big ones for me. Like Melancholy and Siamese Dream is where I really noticed drum sounds, especially Melancholy. Every song is so different. Guitar tones, vocal deliveries, reverbs, lack of reverbs. And that's probably the biggest one is the Pumpkins records. And, you know, those were made by, at least Melancholy was made by my Mount Rushmore of recording guys, which is Flood and Alan Mulder.
Yeah.
So I follow their work more than anything. They also did like the Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails. And you could dive into any of those and just the sounds are so different from anything else.
So you mentioned, you know, teaching yourself how to use a karaoke machine to record guitar stuff. What was your first experience maybe recording a band you were in, or maybe a friend's band or something like that? Do you remember, like, what was that circumstance?
It was the classic Tascam 4-track that I think a lot of recording dudes end up with when they're young. My dad got me a Porta Studio. It's like the famous one everyone had. And I was like, whoa, what a step up from the karaoke machine, right? Like, I could plug two mics into this. So I figured out how to do the whole multi-track thing on that, how to bounce tracks down, and I would invite friends over and we would just cover songs. It would just be like, cool, I'm gonna play guitar. You know, I had like a Line 6 sort of pod thing, record it direct into there and bounce it down, then record vocals. And I would take it to my band practice and record the band, and had no real idea that I could pursue it as a career. That came way later. Even when I was recording bands at the first incarnation of my recording studio in downtown LA, to me, it still wasn't like a career. It was just something that like I knew how to do, and it beat like working retail or something. So I just kind of went with it.
Did you have a spot before Earth Capital?
No.
Or were you? Okay. So you were there the entire, like you found that spot and you made it Earth Capital. And how long were you there? Like
17 years. Yeah.
Man,
crazy.
What was the first band that you recorded at Earth Capital?
There was probably the first stage of what kind of became Silver Snakes was a band I did that didn't even really have a name.
in 2005, I think, with different members of different bands. And we recorded three songs, like a three-song demo there that me and the guitarist, my good friend Matt Leal, we recorded that together. So I remember doing that. And the first actual band, there's two that I think were around the same time, a band called Birds Are Explosives, which was like an El Monte band of like local kids, kind of sound like the Blood Brothers.
That's to say, that's a very sassy kind of band name.
Sounds, super
it's
sassy.
Cool, it's a cool band name, actually.
I ran into the singer of that band, works at the Echo, and I ran into him recently, and we kind of talked about it for a bit.
Wow.
I remember recording them, and then I recorded right after that in 2006. This is the first thing I ever recorded that ended up on vinyl before that Cathedrals record, was a band called Arches, which is Kyle from Graf Orlock's first band.
Oh, fuck. I remember
Kyle,
them.
The singer of yeah. Graf Orlock. Yeah. He sang. It was kind of like a Jerome's Dream kind of screamo-ish band.
Yeah.
I recorded them. And that was the first, like, okay, these are guys that I don't know. I don't know how they found me, how I found them. And that was it. And that kind of sent me down that path of doing the heavy bands, which led me to bands like Restrained and Zabalba and eventually you guys. And yeah, it kind of just snowballed real quick.
Yeah, like how soon after you, Earth Capital was a functional thing, did you find yourself being booked out?
Like about 2 years.
Okay.
Because it took about a year to figure out how to record a band. Because I didn't take lessons in recording or anything either. It just,
yeah, it's trial and error, right?
Yeah. I had hand-me-down equipment from my dad. Anything he wasn't using in his studio anymore, he'd give me. Like, cool, here's some software no one uses. I decided it's not for me. Learn, you know, figure it out. So, okay, cool. So I was recording on Nuendo, which is like a post-production, almost like video game soundtrack software. And I was learning on that. And it took me about a year and a half to kind of get the ins and outs of it. And just a lot of luck ending up with the right bands at the right time that happened to be great performers that... When you're recording a really good, tight band, there's kind of not a wrong way to do it. You could kind of hit record and it kind of does the work for you. You know what I mean? And that's, I'm not trying to completely discredit my role in some of it, but some of those early records that I think people know me of, like I always consider it just the right place and right time for me, whether it's the Touche first record, the Joyce Manor first record, Rotting Out, Zabalba, Nails. These were all just amazing bands with amazing musicians. And I was pressing some buttons and, again, like what luck to be there at that time.
You took some sort of recording classes with Ed Rose, right?
I did. That
so,
was
okay.
In two
yeah,
years
I wanted,
later.
I was going to ask, so like had, so for people listening, Ed Rose, amazing producer out of Kansas, just for a quick reference, he did Parting the Sea Between Brightness and Me from Touche, but he also did like Coalesce and Get Up Kids and the Casket Lottery, all these amazing bands. But I remember you talking about going and doing some classes with him. So Earth Capital had already been established, and was this you
yes.
wanting to like, just sort of like get some new chops, like learn some new things kind of a deal. And what was that like seminar like?
It was just about leveling up, you know, again, like for the first handful of years I was doing the Earth Capital, it still didn't feel like a career to me. It felt like just something I was doing. It felt like a job. And that's how I treated it. You know, I'm very open and I could admit that. I wasn't that passionate about it. It was in my head, I was going to be like Indiana Jones or some like crazy, like archaeologist explorer guy, which anyone that knows me knows I'm still trying to be. so it was just kind of cool. I'm just going to moonlight recording bands while I'm out there digging for treasure in the mountains. And I saw that Ed Rose's studio is called the Black Lodge in Eudora, Kansas, put out something saying they were doing the Black Lodge recording workshop. And I talked to my dad about it and my mom, and they helped me out. We like split the cost of it. And I drove out to Eudora in 2009. And I was out there for a while, recorded a band with Ed, learned how to tune drums, learned anything I could about like the inner workings of dealing with a band in the studio. And more than anything, I think learning studio etiquette and just, that was my first time in a like a rock recording session, you know. I had only been in small sessions with my own bands or with my dad and his stuff. But being in there with a producer who I had known for doing some of my favorite records. I mean, we all love the Casket Lottery, right? And like, whoa, I'm standing in the room where they did Survivalist for Cowards. Or this is right
best
when...
Best sounding record, man.
Exactly. And this is right when the Coalesce record Ox came out, which is
right.
an insane sounding record.
Totally.
So I got to just sit there and pick Ed's brain about all that stuff. And I'm so thankful for, you know, for him. And I wish that his name was cemented there a bit more for kids these days, because he made some classics, man. And he's out of the game now, but
when he was at the top of his game, which was for a long time, he was making crazy sounding records and very just very matter of factual about it. Like, I get great sounds, and you know, he just did his job and it was killer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and you, especially for bands in Southern California, you know, I wanted to talk to you about the idea of like punk rock guilt when it comes to charging for anything, whether it's t-shirts, whether it is, you know, you have always been notorious for like, you'll record these like crust punk bands, hardcore bands or whatever, you know, you'll give them a couple days, charge a couple $100, like very reasonable, a price that like most bands can figure out how to scrape together and afford. And you were given quality sounding demos or EPs or records or whatever. And, you know, based off conversations you and I have had over these years, like there's that hard thing to sort of overcome that and sort of like start charging more, start charging what you're worth kind of a thing. But do you feel like you would have changed that in any regard, considering like the amount of experience you had recording all these bands for such, you know, a low amount, but like steady work, right?
I think I could have. I think I could have charged probably double what I was doing back in the day, and still the bands that still had a big impact on my career, I think still would have been there. And that's me having to come to terms with like, okay, I did bring something to the table with a lot of these bands, you know? But it was always, and this comes from how I was saying earlier, wanting bands, young bands, to have a good experience, their first recording experience. And it's like, it was more so like, no one else is out there doing this big brother type program for these young bands. Like, so I guess I have to do it. And I've always been very realistic about like what my ratio is with my overhead at my studio. And at my old place in downtown, it's like, cool, I'm paying a couple $100 a month to be here. Realistically, I got to work 2 days and my rent's covered. So there's no reason I have to charge more than X amount of dollars to do this. And couple that with not really knowing how to, you know, I wish I would have interned under a guy or worked at like a proper studio in LA to learn the inner workings of the process. But to me, it was like, band shows up, they do their thing, I hit record, I balance it and give it back to them, their record's done. You know, the end. I didn't learn about like, oh, I'm supposed to spend a week mixing this after. Oh, this is how I'm supposed to edit this. I just didn't learn any of that. So it worked out with a lot of these heavier bands, especially in that like grind scene, crust punk and hardcore scene, to where I knew what I wanted to hear from them. I knew what they wanted to hear. Sometimes we had similar influences. So I could do it affordably to where, you know, I think the first Touche record, we did that in 4 days. That was 4 days.
I can't even remember it being four days. I would think it was like two. That's crazy.
With me showing up to like bounce, mix and bounce the tracks, it was 4 days total.
Okay. Okay.
So, I mean, you got to figure that record there. It wasn't the conventional like, oh, drums are done. Cool. I'm going to edit these for 2 days. Come back and we'll do this. It's like, drums are done. Cool. Nick, set up your bass.
Yeah.
Cool. Bass is done. All right, guys, let's set up your guitars. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was just bam, 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 bam. Then you came in, did vocals. And man, I look back so fondly on those days because it was just, it was all just urgency. We're all shooting from the hip and we didn't have to stop and overthink the process. Yeah. It didn't matter. The most character recording thing about, I think, doing that first record with you guys, with the Touche record, was I don't know why I thought it would be really cool to throw like a mic in the corner when you're doing the vocals. And that ended up being like the whole vocal sound for the record is a room mic.
Right.
Like there's hardly any of the up close mic. And I think it lent a cool character to, you know,
and
songs like Honest Sleep or the opening, the clapping, you know what I mean? That's just the sound of a $30 mic in the corner of the room.
And I mean, talk about a vibe that has been on every single recording that we've ever done.
Yeah, right?
You know,
scream from the back of the room.
Scream from the back of the room. Like for people listening, I mean, like so much of that sound that is on every single Touche record was inspired by that, where it's like, oh, set a mic up in the corner of the room and I'll just yell in that direction. And
yeah,
that gives that sort of feeling for it. So when I've had a couple other producers on here, one of the things that's kind of fun to ask them is like what kind of advice you would give to a kid who's thinking about getting in that field or like wanting to build a studio. Like, what do you think now with all this hindsight you would tell somebody like the first thing to kind of like focus on when it comes to like maybe building a studio or getting that off the ground?
I think it takes years, if not like a decade or more, to really hone your skills, no matter how many resources you have, to get to what could be deemed like a semi-professional sound, you know what I mean? Even in this day and age. And no matter how far technology goes, or even with AI or whatever,
I think there's always going to be a seat at the table for just internal skill, internal talent, whether that is like something that I always try to see as a strong point in my, you know, my tool set is pitch. So when I work with a band, like being very familiar with tuning and pitch. And I think if people could focus on at least one or two things, get really good at it, then they're always going to have something to offer and they're never going to have to worry about being out of a job, because that's not something that can be replaced with technology down the line, in my opinion. Obviously with, you know, you got auto tune and stuff like that, but that's why, like, personally, I try to focus more on like the character that comes out of a vocalist. And you know what I mean? Being able to show someone like, hey, your tuner says you're on, but when you move to this note, it's off. Like, we got to correct that. The tuner's not going to tell you that. So I think that's really important. Like, build a few like specialties into your toolkit and take that with there. Take that with you everywhere you go. Knowing a little bit of each instrument, knowing, I mean, it really helps that I can get away with playing drums, guitar, bass, whatever, because I can communicate that with people. I don't have to sit there with a drummer and go, oh, when you go dun-dun-dun, or, you know, I can say there and be like, hey, you're crossing your arms over and you're missing this ghost note with your left hand. Try doing this with your right hand and switching to this instead. You know, having that language and being able to speak the language of music goes really far with people. And I think they appreciate it because you kind of facilitate a smoother process. So I think that's very important. I think that's more important than buying a bunch of gear and, you know, paying tuition thousands upon thousands of dollars to learn on gear that you might not even get the ability to be using your first decade in the studio. So I think it's really useful to have those real world musician skills first and foremost.
That's very well said. That's very well said. And I mean, for people who are familiar with this podcast that have, you know, heard me talk to, you know, Barry or anyone like that, like Barry from Joyce Manor, like, you know, you have always been someone that is a mandatory part of any Touche record, the same way you've been a mandatory part of every Joyce Manor record when it comes to getting me comfortable with what I'm doing vocally, because we will go to you and basically pre-production an entire record, record the entire record before going in to do it again. You know, that kind of help and that kind of guidance is you can't put a dollar amount on it. So, you know, I know I've told you that to you, but I just wanted to get that on the mic for people to listen, just like how appreciative I am of what you bring for this band and my musical career.
I appreciate that too. Yeah, I appreciate that too from bands like you guys, Joyce Manor, and really any band that's put their art in my hands, because I don't take that lightly at all, you know. And how I said early on in my career, I saw it as just a job. I think I had this crazy like reawakening about 6 years ago where I was like, oh crap, like I'm an adult. I'm not, this is like what I do. I'm recording bands. So I don't know. I think some people noticed when I kind of rebranded my studio to the whole Pale Moon thing years ago, that was me kind of trying to level it up.
Yeah.
Owning that it's my job and just seeing it in a different light and having this new space here at the ranch and getting to see other producers that I admire work here. Cause I rent this space out to freelancers as well. It's so cool. I feel like I'm learning more about it every day. And the fact that a band like you guys, that Touche still has kind of followed me up here and I'm still working with you guys, or even a band like Rotting Out who came to me 10 years after we had last worked together to do another single with me, or you know what I mean, little things.
Yeah.
When Joyce Manor was at God City doing 40 ounces, I think it was it that record?
Was it $1 million?
No, $1 million. When they were at God City doing $1 million, you know, I was talking to Barry through like voice notes, trying to give him like harmony ideas for parts. Or,
yeah,
you know, I got to do the first song on 40 Ounces to Fresno. I got to produce the first song on that record. It's, you know, over 10 years after I did the first Joyce Manor demo. So like, I am so thankful to have all you guys in my career, in my life still, and especially as friends, because it's cool to watch all you guys grow as musicians and do cool things. Like I feel like I'm like the biggest cheerleader for all these bands I got to work with, and I follow them as fans, and yeah, it's been a cool ride.
Well, the feeling is mutual, my friend, which leads us to the last question, which is, when was the first time you felt like you were doing the thing you'd been working so hard towards?
You know what? And you know, after everything I said, I guess it's a multifaceted thing, because with playing music, there's those moments that I had on tour and like, you know, the first time you see someone sing along to one of your songs and what have you, that's always like something really special. But as far as just like an adult who works in music, who's like, you know, that's a dream in general to make a career out of music. Realistically, every single day I've had in the last year being here at the ranch has been that. It's the magic of this place too and how special this place is. But every morning I wake up here and it's just been like, oh, what do I got to do today? Oh, I have to go downstairs and mix a cool song. I have to, like, you know, Touche's coming over today. You know what I mean? It's just, it's so cool. And it's like, it took a lot of time because I've been doing this for going on 20 years now. And 20 years later, now that I'm here, I feel that every single day, like now in like 2024, I've been waking up just thinking like, whoa, I'm doing it. And that's the first time I've been comfortable saying that out loud and saying it to myself that, dude, you're doing it. You're doing the thing. Like, this is awesome.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, keep up the good work. We're all very appreciative. And if anyone in, or I mean, you don't have to be in California. If anyone just like wants to get out and go to a gorgeous place and enjoy some time recording a record, you know, definitely Pale Moon is the way to go. So thanks so much for your time, man. This has been great.
Thank you.
And that is our show. Thank you so much to Alex for coming on, and thank you for listening. This episode was edited, produced, and made to sound so great by Ryan Rainbow. Shout out to Ryan. And reminder, there's a bonus episode available right now where Alex answered questions that were submitted by subscribers. You can find the link to that in the episode description, or just head on over to patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon. Thank you. Take care. Be good. Bye-bye.